Enterprise Influencers, perspectives from technology leaders. Hello and welcome to Enterprise Influencers. Today we have Tony Saylor with us. Patrick, tell us a bit more about what's going on.
Hey, Giles. Good to be back. It's been a long holiday siesta for us, but we're happy to be back recording Enterprise Influencers. And today we're going to be talking about driving product strategy through user research. And I'm really excited to have Tony Saylor on the call with us today on the podcast. Tony is a senior user experience researcher with Microsoft. She works on the SharePoint Online and OneDrive team at Microsoft. And as I'm sure many of our listeners know, Giles and I have a long history with SharePoint, even longer than Tony's history with SharePoint. We're really excited. And over the last several number of years, there's been a lot of changes in, especially around the UX as it relates to SharePoint and a lot of the Microsoft cloud tools and some really exciting developments and some really talented folks like Tony who are helping to bring those to light. So we're really excited to have her on the show today. Tony, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you're doing at Microsoft?
Yeah, like you said, I'm a senior UXR or UX researcher at Microsoft. I work primarily on OneDrive at the moment, but in the past, y'all know me from working on SharePoint, and I also worked on Viva Connection. And before this, I worked at Primera Blue Cross, which is a health insurance organization in Washington, and I worked on their mobile apps also as a user experience researcher. And even before that, I got my master's in human-centered design and engineering from the University of Washington and a BS in mechanical engineering from Olin College of Engineering.
Go Huskies, right?
Yeah.
Is that, yeah.
I have to confess I didn't go to a single sports event while I was getting that master's.
You probably got good grades, though. Yeah. Awesome. We hear terms like UX researcher, UXR, things, you know, UX experience, all these different things. And we've talked about it on previous episodes a bit. The research component to me is somewhat fascinating. I'm like really interested, especially in a team that's really focused on enterprise software, which is the focus of our podcast, The Enterprise. I'm really curious how, in your words, where does that UX research really come into play? Like, how do you spend your day? How do you fit in with the product teams? What would you say you do here?
Yeah, I like to say, and I swear my parents, I've explained it 100 times and they still don't understand what I do, but my job is to bring the user perspective into the product making process. So my job is to represent the customer or the end user in all the interactions I have with the product team. And my expertise is in like cultivating those insights. So either by running user studies or by maintaining customer relationships, which is how we all know each other, and then using those insights to influence what decisions the product team makes. So for how I spend my day, it's a mix of all of those things. I would say for the most part, I'm attending a lot of meetings where I'm trying to buy questions the team has and whether or not we need to undertake a full study to answer them, whether or not the customer relationships we have, that's a better audience, or if we already have the data to answer those questions, as well as just providing like subject matter expertise, because I've been doing this for a while. So I see themes across my experience. And then sometimes, some days I'm doing studies, like I'm planning them, or I'm actually running the interviews, or I'm analyzing the data that came out of them, or writing reports. And then, yeah, I think that's most of it.
It strikes me as there's a lot of relationship building, especially with customers, that has to happen. I'm sure, like you said, cultivating those relationships and knowing, I guess, which ones to prioritize or deprioritize, or which ones are crazy and just asking for the world. And I'm sure I've never done that in any call that we've ever had, but
I think also what you said about cultivating relationships, it's both with, there's a lot of stakeholders involved in the Microsoft ecosystem in particular, because there's IT administrators and there's the end users who use the product, and there's, I even consider my own teammates stakeholders in the research process. So I have to be cultivating those relationships too, and aware of what type of information those people most respond to in order to better influence what ends up happening in the product. But yeah, what you were talking about with like tensions between what different groups of users want is a thing that happens all the time.
I never really thought about that from the sort of internal politicking perspective. It makes total sense that some teams or folks would, I'm sure you work with product managers of different aspects of the product, where they would respond to feedback about their product in different ways, or they may, the one customer may weigh more heavily in their mind than another, or a certain type of data point may weigh more heavily on their decision making.
Yes, and it also totally changes depending on what's going on at Microsoft all up as well. There might be pushes for advocating for different types of customers, like maybe education tenants. We have a push going on where we want to make those better. Then I would need to know that's where the pressure is coming from, and that's the pressure being put on the PM in order to help like better serve them, essentially.
Yeah. So if you can understand your customers' motivations, your product manager's motivations, and then you can somehow mix all that together in some big UX gumbo, and then now we and magic happens.
Perfect. Yeah. And I think it's also just being empathetic to, I think we were going to talk about this a little later, but being empathetic to what my coworkers are going on. I report up through a research organization, which ultimately reports up through a design organization. So I don't report in the same structure as the product managers or the, and so often it's not obvious to me what they're getting for their own career path that might be influencing what they're asking for and what they're pushing for the product.
Makes sense. I know you wanted to, being the SharePoint guy, I know you wanted to get into some SharePoint stuff, so.
Sure.
So this, so as you know, we've been talking for a little while about you guys coming on, and one of the reasons why I reached out to you was because I've been doing SharePoint. I'm in my mid-40s now, and I started in my mid-20s, so I think that says all. But as a result, it as a product, it has fundamentally changed, like completely. Mm-hmm. It's gone from files all the way out here. It came back a little bit, and then it's gone online, and then they completely changed the UI and to a more modern piece, all that kind of stuff. And I can only assume, because certainly I see the likes of Vesa, so I things like that at Microsoft. I remember meeting him working on like Great Plains stuff when I was at Microsoft back in 2004. And there's a lot of history going on inside the company, and because they know the history of how the product has grown up. And then when I look at, say, your LinkedIn, you're coming in from the side, you're bringing in fresh approach. My mind is really needed, to be honest. So it's really good, the direction it's going. But I can imagine there's kind of tension in that approach, because there's my baby kind of attitude behind it potentially or something like that. And I know that suddenly on my products and projects that I work on, I have a sense of closeness that I might get a bit attached to as a result. So really, how do you handle that? Because you must also have product managers who are also coming in fresh with their own ideas at the same time. There's a massive mix of pot there. And then, and like I say, these, the Jeff Teepers of the world have been there for a long time, and Feisinger and all that kind of stuff, right? Like they've been there for a very, very long time, and they've taken approaches, and I'm sure they swing and change as things move forward. But I could imagine that history also takes its part. All that decision as well. So how do you handle that?
Even now, but especially the first year, I feel like everything we would suggest, someone would have said we'd done before and we tried it, or it didn't work out in this sort of way. So there was a lot of learning about the past of SharePoint. But I think you pointed out there's actually a couple of tensions. There's like the, like, not, we say moving the cheese of the existing customers. We don't want to unduly change things that people are attached to, or they've learned how to do a certain way. So I think it just makes the bar higher for what we ship. Like, we really have to prove it's worth the upset, that what we're doing will meaningfully improve the UX. And in a new product, you maybe wouldn't have to overcome that burden of, it really, if we're going to make people upset, it better be for a good reason. And then I think there's another tension between what IT administrators want and what end users of the product want. And it's that one's a lot harder to balance and comes up, I think, quite a lot. It's basically if the IT administrators aren't happy with what we're shipping, they won't turn it on for their tenants. So even if we think it's the most amazing thing ever, if it's not going to be on when it gets there, like we really need to work with IT administrators to make sure that they are satisfied and they feel like what we're doing is protecting their users and it's great. But also sometimes end users come back and think the product is too locked down or too restrictive, or it doesn't give them the controls that they want. And we have to balance that concern with the admins wanting control over everything too, for good reason.
Yeah, it's interesting working in a product that has a 20 plus year history. I can imagine you've got users who say, well, I was always able to do this, whatever that feature is, whatever that thing. So the balance of trying to provide feature parity with also now trying to innovate and give people new things and a new look and feel and make it easy for them. But then there's going to be a certain subset of people that are always going to lock in on, I can't do this thing that I've done for 15 years. And so it maybe inhibits your ability to change the product.
I think there's like a core, especially on SharePoint, there's a core like product value or something that we're trying to do where we do make it easy for people who don't know how to do web design to try and be able to create SharePoint sites. And classic SharePoint, you both know, is not that way. We say you have to have had a degree in SharePoint to figure out how to use it. But the trade-off was like it was very difficult, but you had pixel perfect control over everything.
That's exactly site. And Giles and I both made plenty of good consulting money on making pixel perfect SharePoint sites for <That's right. laughs>
Yeah, so then when we launched Modern, and to be candid, I only have seen it for the last 4 years, but we had things a lot more locked down. Even the font is the same font for everything, and you don't have that control, which makes it easier for new people and people who don't have web design experience to use SharePoint, but there's that trade-off of you don't have that control anymore.
Yeah, well, I think as it's transitioned from really a client server product that you hosted in your own data center to now something that's probably primarily, although it's still available as that in some respects, right? It's primarily consumed through Microsoft 365 as a cloud-based offering. And so that's also like you're able to innovate a lot faster as a cloud-based offering because you can do releases, you can do stuff. Maybe in some cases you can do A/B type testing. You can try some things. Like there's a lot more options as a product team to you than a release cycle that's tied to a 3-year calendar, and which is what it used to be in the old days.
Yeah. There's a trade-off there too, though, of surprise updating IT admins and having them not be well prepared for what we're doing. So we try to avoid that too.
Yeah, we've been there and done that.
Yeah.
I can tell you that the company that I'm in right now, they mostly work in the defense sector and they are as archaic as you'd expect. How they're currently starting to embrace the cloud, which is fascinating for me because I've been in that cloud state for the last 10 years. So it's really interesting to see how they do it. And of course, their products are also in that state as well. So in a similar way, I've got lots of juxtapositions. It's not just about actually the development and the design of things. It's also about why are we not doing waterfall anymore and product management. So there's a lot of, I guess, unwarranted drama, I would argue. Sorry, I guess you're listening. But anyway, so what's my point is, I guess as part of what you talked about, your research and then obviously your education's in that point as well. And one of the things that me and Patrick were talking about as we came up with this kind of high level agenda is, you know, how do you buy these things, right? Because I'm sure you've got a lot of the people out there who they want to see the facts, right? It's always been done this way. Or as you said previously, we have already tried that. But of course, in the hearts of minds of your customers, yeah, it might have been tried 5 years ago, but maybe things have evolved. Like you were saying, mm-hmm. you know, it was quite rigid, the design, with the way things are consumed nowadays. I don't get to control what's going on my phone. It's delivered to me. And my only choice is, do I stay with that phone or not? And honestly, it's a lot less stressful as a result.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that you have to justify both from a qualitative point of view and a quantitative point of view. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that? You talked about how you have research behind the scenes that you can go back to and things like that.
Yes. For me, like, that's another thing that it's both dependent on the research question that the team has. For more context, I'm going to all those feature crew meetings and listening and hearing when they start having a debate that they don't have evidence for. That's when I step in and go, can we get that evidence? And sometimes right. we already have research on it, but often we don't. And so then the question becomes what type of research to do, which is usually dependent on the question. And so let's say the question is A better than B? We have two options for a design. Sorry, my cat's joining us.
I think that's our first cat on the podcast.
That is our first cat. Hi, cat.
This is Luna.
Hi, Luna. Special
guest Luna.
If so, let's say we have like design option A and design option B, and we think there's reasons A is better, and we think there's reasons B is better, and we want to know which one we should go forward with. There's a couple ways I could approach even that question. I'm definitely doing an A-B test where I ask customers go through tasks on A and they go through tasks on B, and then they rate their experiences, and I just get to see what their peer success is and all of that sort of stuff. But the question of qualitative versus quantitative, and not to oversimplify because there's always both in all the studies, but it really depends again on the team and the goals and who the data needs to go up to, because there are some PMs I work with who they want to know not necessarily A is better than B all the time. They want to know what aspects of A are better than B, what aspects of B are better than A, and why someone might still choose A even though they said three other things on B were better than it.
Yeah.
And that sort of detail, which is hard to get at a quantitative scale. So that would be more likely to be done qualitatively via one-on-one interviews. And I purely just can't do more than 12 of those in a week. So that's the limitation on qual, I think. And then for quantitative, you will get a more objective answer, right? Like you can get to statistical significance and determine absolutely A is better than B. And you can get some info about why, but you won't get the level of detail that you would get from a qualitative study. So that would also depend if I have a PM who really, maybe they need to report this up to Jeff Tepper and they want to have that like definitive answer of A is better than B and we're confident why.
It's interesting too, because I imagine the UX research that you're able to do at Microsoft working in SharePoint and OneDrive is probably different than maybe like what you were able to do with a mobile app at a Primerica or like another UX researcher, maybe that's working on a public facing website where you're maybe actually have a little bit more freedom to put some visual, like actually do some live A/B testing or things like that. Like it's a different type of scenario because you're working in a enterprise product that people are doing business on. And so you can't change the way something looks just on the fly because like, then that's going to generate a support ticket and your IT administrator is going to be really angry at you and things like that.
Yeah, we do. The engineering teams do A/B testing sometimes. So what you were talking about of like on live code, sending it out to customers and you don't know which group you're in. And then we just track clicks or like success rates on what we are looking for. And that is something the teams do sometimes. But yes, for me, there are limitations. We do a lot of prototype studies when we're doing evaluative research. So I don't know if you've heard about evaluative versus generative research, but evaluative is what it sounds like. You're evaluating the viability of a concept or the usability of something that's already built. And generative is generating ideas. So it might be something more like trying to determine what things users want to do, whether or not we have a solution to do them yet, which will also lead the product to come up with ways to solve those user needs. But on evaluative, we often are using prototypes. And then I do a lot of testing for benchmarks, which are big, large scale usability tests that we do annually on the products to like track progress and usability over time. And those involve a lot of demo tenants and a lot of crazy login information and all kinds of difficulty in the testing environment. And it's gotten more difficult during the pandemic because we used to be able to have a controlled lab environment. So if we had something that was pre-release, we could test it in the lab where we know no one can take any screenshots or share it externally. But now that we're doing almost all of our testing remotely, there are those challenges where there's some things we can't really test remotely because we can't risk it getting leaked to Wired.
Yeah, you don't want the newest Veeva product being leaked to the world.
Yeah, I was working on Veeva Connections when it was what we call tented, in we weren't allowed to release any information about it. And that was a difficult thing. We were limited to generative research in some sense because we couldn't be specific, show screens to a product.
The running joke in Giles and I's world is not working at Microsoft is that every product that Microsoft releases these days has to have Veeva in the title.
It's the theme.
Yeah.
I will admit to making that joke internally as well. Even existing products have gotten remade.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Every time we hear about something new, we're like, okay, when's this going to get slapped?
When's it going to be? Eva?
Yeah, for sure.
So another question that kind of comes to mind is that with the Veeva stuff, right? When it first started to come out, it really is a step left of the M365 suite because it's a concentration on people and welfare. And then the analytics. So there was a hint of that previously with the analytics modules and stuff like that that were built in that have now become Veeva products and things like that. So when it comes to researching how that should look, which in many ways you might argue there are companies out there that kind of are doing that as their own product, but bringing it into the Microsoft ecosystem is a new thing, which is hard for necessarily people to get the concepts going. And I know Patrick and I have in the past been trying to sell it internally. Is this a good idea or not? Where do you start from the research on that? Because
that was another complicated one.
How do you explain what you're trying to do and the benefit of it, right, in the first place? So
yeah, there's a lot of different user profiles for that as well, because there's the like corporate communicators who are mostly invested in like the Veeva Connections feed, and then there's HR at companies, and that's even just the people who administer it, but then there's also the people who are receiving it, and there's experiences for managers, and there's experience for individual contributors and for frontline workers versus information workers. And so it was and I'm sure continues to be a very complicated process of balancing everyone's individual needs. Everyone involved was excited about the goal of humanizing work in that sense that you were talking about, and making it more like making a product that made it easier to have a caring workplace that cares about your mental health or giving praise to coworkers and all that sort of stuff. So I think in some ways it was easy because everyone was like, you can't disagree with that sort of goal for a product.
Right. I'm sure.
And then other ways it was difficult because. Because also we did get some disagreement from customers, especially like individual contributor information workers are just like, just let me get back to my job. I'm looking only towards what I'm doing next. And so I think it's also representative of a mindset shift for how you interact with work that not everyone is on board with.
Yeah, in many ways, the pandemic probably helped in many ways, right?
Because
made the whole world shift, and now you're at home and all this kind of stuff, and everything's more digital. And in many ways, it came at the right time, although I'm sure Microsoft was working on it for years before that.
Yeah. And I think younger people entering the workforce too have like more expectations. I think the pandemic and younger people entering at the same time also accelerated like what people expect from their workplace in terms of the care that they get. And like we call it at Microsoft, the deal, like what your company gives to you and what you give to your company, I feel like really shifted over the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that resonates with a lot of folks. And while I am one of those like evil IT administrative types that you're talking about that likes to complain about, you moved my cheese and you turned this thing on without telling us, you're talking about how having these conversations internally at Microsoft about impacting people's work-life balance, the way that they perceive their relationship with the employer. And we've had several of these types of conversations with other folks, either from a consulting perspective or implementing some of the Microsoft products and things like that. But it seems pretty cool that you get to be on the front line of making that type of impact. Maybe you can just talk a little bit about that, like what that means to you as in terms of like your professional, you get to get up every day and build something cool that people get to utilize in their day-to-day life and at work, at least.
Yeah, I think like launches are a big deal and obviously very exciting when they happen. But I actually think day-to-day, the thing that gets me out of bed and to doing this job is just the responsibility to the users and the customers and like wanting to do our best by them and feeling inspired by the things I learn from them. And I think one of your questions that we haven't gotten to yet is about what happens when your intuition is wrong. That's my favorite time. That is part of why I love doing this job, because I'm wrong all the time about what people are going to want. And that's why I think it's valuable to have user experience researchers, because data point of one.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think I came by my opinion naturally, but someone else has a very different opinion from me.
And we won't talk about what opinions are, but we all have intuition. And I come from a technical background, writing code and consulting and doing these things, but I also found a love for user experience and graphic design. Not that I can really, not that I'm a practitioner of those things myself, but I love working with those skill sets and find a lot of value in utilizing those skill sets to make a product better. But not a lot of times, like you may know what you think the path is, but then, you know, that gets out into the real world, right? And then how you thought people were going to use something is often not how they end up using it, right? Mm-hmm. And even like SharePoint as a product, like in its early days, like it was going to be a file repository, and then people ended up doing all kinds of stuff. And then Microsoft saw that as an opportunity and they started building upon it. That's at a macro level, but that even happens at I'm sure a micro level as mm-hmm. well. I'm sure there's some perfect anecdotes that maybe you're allowed to, or maybe you're not allowed to share with us.
Yeah, I think a lot of the SharePoint features in particular end up getting like jury-rigged to do different things than we expected. But then I love that, like, an important part of my job is working with data science and with customer support, who are the ones who really get to see that happening, to make sure that when we go back through our next iteration, we're incorporating how people are actually using the thing versus what we thought people would do with it. I can't think of any like specific examples at the moment.
And you alluded to this earlier. So, you know, obviously sometimes, even though the research says, yes, the quantitative interest and such as you put it out there, and then the market says no, how do you claw yourself back from that and then turn it into eventually the good, right? Like, mm-hmm. obviously these things evolve, right? And sometimes it might be just people's opinion at the time and their opinions change versus actually we got it wrong.
Yeah.
Have you been in those situations? How do you have any thoughts on how that shifts and things like that?
Yes. So my hot take is that research is never wrong, but sometimes we're involved.
But you're only doing a subset of people, right? Like,
yes. You just didn't have all the data.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
But the data that you get was correct.
So caveats to that hot take are that I'm not a market researcher. I'm like researching the concept and the usability and maybe even like the like opportunity spaces within the product. But I have seen things go out that there wasn't good market fit for. Sure. But then, and then the other caveat is that the research and the study design tells you the answer to however you designed it. For you, however you designed it is what it will tell you. And so I think, yes, you could design the wrong study and therefore get the wrong information. And I most often see that happening when research comes in a little too late in the process. Sure. Like we're only basically the last check before it goes out the door of can people hit the button, yes or no, then we've missed the opportunity to go, is that the right place for the button? Should the button even exist? Does anyone right. want the button? And I think the earlier we get involved, the more likely the research isn't wrong.
Yeah. About things. Well, that's I think that's a really good point and dovetails into one of the topics I wanted to hit on here, which is you're working with different product teams, and you alluded to some of the corporate structure at Microsoft where you don't maybe necessarily report directly in to the product team. Your sort of research is a separate group, but I'm curious. I see value in user experience and research and these things. And like you said, the earlier you bring it in, the better, you know, that research can be and the greater impact it could have to the, in the end, which is what you want, happy user at the end of the day. I'm curious, like if there's any, maybe there's product teams out there or organizations that maybe aren't prioritizing these sorts of things. And maybe they're looking to implement some of this into their own product designs, into their own organization. And honestly, like, it's not just a product question. It's an organization question. It's a, like, IT organization should be looking at their user experience. Every organization should be looking at, and that's how we get customer experience. We get employee experience. We get the user experience. It's all a root off of this. So is there advice that you would give to maybe organizations out there that are maybe taking their first foray into user experience research, and what do I look at first? How do I prioritize it? How do I actually get value from this, right? Because it can sometimes seem a little conceptual maybe, but there's true value in understanding like what your users want you to build.
Yeah, I have two pieces of advice. One is hire a user experience researcher. I do think that there's sometimes a perception that there's not special expertise towards doing user experience research, and that's not true at all. We have training and we have education in how to do and how to create unbiased studies and design experiments, and that if you don't know how to do those things, you really can do wrong research.
So before you move on to your second point, tell our audience, like, hey, you mentioned human-computer interaction. What are some degree programs that, like, you should look for? What are some certifications you should look for in their first hire for a user experience researcher?
Yeah, so most of the programs come out of human-computer interaction, like you said. There's also some that are titled, like, human factors, which tends to be more on physical
manufacturing.
And yes. And then
I'm an industrial engineer studied all that stuff a long time ago. But
and then I think there's becoming more programs that use the language UX.
Yeah.
And then it's just figuring out if you want to do UX research or UX design.
Awesome. And sorry, so before I interrupted, you were going to make a second point.
I was going to continue the first point just a little bit, that I think it's also useful to have someone on the team whose job is to represent the user, because at least the way Microsoft works, the PM is the one who makes the call on what we end up shipping and how, but they're trying to balance the business needs, which they're representing, and they're trying to balance feasibility, which engineering is representing. And so I think it's useful to have another party whose job it is to represent the customer and alleviate some of that tension on the product team to have to be warring with themselves on the business decision and the user experience. And then the other thing I was going to suggest is to think of it that way, to think of balancing the business need and the feasibility and the user experience, and think of user experience as like a core part of that equation. I think traditionally we've only tried to balance the business need and the feasibility, but I think including user experience as your third pillar for what you need to do when you're launching a product will lead you down the road of having a better user experience.
Yeah. And you also mentioned something there, like research versus design. And so everybody knows there are unicorns out there that can do it all, but that's not generally the case, yep. right? Like a lot of times, like your researcher is not also the one creating your design or vice versa. So maybe spend a minute or so, if you can just speak to that a little bit, like what maybe some of the specialized skill sets there are.
Yeah, I think in smaller companies, they are still having designers do their own research for the most part. But I do think, again, like I said, there's expertise in being a researcher, but there's also value in being a little bit more unbiased. If I'm the one who does the actual design, and then I'm also the one sending it to people or moderating people evaluating it, there's a little bit more ego in it than
the
than
button's
I'm,
there
like,
because
impartial.
That's where it's the prettiest, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
it has to be blue. It's like my favorite color.
Third yeah. party to it. Yeah. And designers typically are more focused on the actual design, so maybe the visual design, but also the interaction design and how they want the experience to make users feel, and then it's my job to evaluate if the design is successful.
Yeah, and they're also evaluating some of the same constraints, right? Does the business function need to be the feasibility of this design, and then is it representing what the user wants to do too? So I love how it all comes together, right? Very cool. Very interesting conversation, and like I think a lot of good insights for our audience. I really appreciate that. So I think we're coming up to the end of our time together here. And Tony, I did warn you before the call that we have a tradition here on Enterprise Influencers podcast of asking our guests to share with us some type of fun fact, anecdote, a joke, whatever you would like to share with our audience. But Tony Saylor of Microsoft fame, what is your fun fact?
My fun fact is that while I was at mechanical engineering school, I think my most successful project was I made a real life version of Harry Potter wizard's chess, where you could voice control chess pieces and play a chess game.
You win. That was very good.
That was fantastic.
My wife is currently jealous. She doesn't know that yet.
Send you a link to the website we made for it.
Wonderful. This has been a really interesting conversation. I love like the passion that you bring to UX research. I appreciate all the work that you're doing to drag some of these products like SharePoint into the modern world. And I'm sure, even though I'm sure like SharePoint's one of those products that many people love to hate, but you are making it easier to love. We really appreciate that, Tony. And I think, Giles, you want to take us out?
Sure. I would just say you're also dragging old fogies like us.
That's right.
into modern society as well. Thank you. So you know, today's perspectives from Enterprise Influencers has been Tony Saylor. Thank you very much. Patrick, as always, thank you. You can see us at the usual podcast haunts, Google, Apple, YouTube, etc. So I'm going to say goodbye and thank you everybody for joining.